we both sort of had, each had had this idea of what a farm in the city could be that was different than anything that we had seen previously. Most of the farms were either like agricultural focused or education focused, and they weren't really about community. And not to say that there wasn't a community there. All of those farms have community, have very strong community cultures, but it wasn't about open public embracing of people and of the farm as a fixture, as part of the social fabric of a community.
Serendipity brought Ryan Watson and Henry Sweets together, unified by their vision of the power of urban farming to improve the health of local communities. They spent 7 years nurturing and building North Brooklyn Farm on the banks of the East River in Brooklyn, nestled under the Williamsburg Bridge. This extraordinary oasis, a gathering place for the local community in the midst of the New York metropolis, recently closed to make space for real estate development. However, in this two-part episode, we discover that Ryan's vision remains clear on the role and need for urban farming. In part one, we discuss Ryan's upbringing, his education, and what influenced him to walk away from a career in corporate law to pursue his love of agriculture and farming, and the genesis of North Brooklyn Farms. In part two, Ryan and I discuss his experience and learnings from running an urban farm and community gathering space for 7 years, and the impact the farm had on the local residents and community in Williamsburg and beyond. We discuss his current rural farming adventure at Wild Russet Farms in the Catskills of New York State, and how a new generation of millennial farmers could create a more sustainable future beyond industrial agriculture. In this honest and wide-ranging discussion, we also cover his views on education, technology, curiosity, risk-taking, failure, persistence, work ethic, values, and farming in the future. I hope you enjoy the contemplative perspectives, social impact, and community-minded spirit of Ryan Watson. So, let's jump in. Ryan, welcome to the Impossible Network podcast, welcoming us to your wonderful farm, Wild Russet Farm, here in the Catskills.
Yeah, our pleasure. That's what we're here for.
It's great. And we obviously we're going to jump into your journey into the world of agriculture and farming. But before we do, we always like to start asking our guests to really explore their lives as they grew up and talking about their childhood. So maybe you could start by telling us about your upbringing. I believe that you were born in Southern California.
Yeah, I guess living in New York, but always Californian at heart a little bit. So I grew up in Los Angeles, just outside of Venice Beach, Mar Vista.
Nice.
I was an only child growing up, played a lot of baseball.
Surfer?
Surfer.
Got to be a surfer in Venice Beach.
Yeah, both my parents were from the East Coast and had made their way out to California.
To do what?
I think to something different, energetically for a shift, which is kind of funny to
return. What were they doing in the East Coast?
Well, my mother was going to school and my father had sort of, I believe he had a bad breakup and California was sort of something new. And I think in this way that my parents moved from one side of the country to the other, that for me was, I always had my eyes on moving to the East Coast. New York for school was sort of
always in the plan.
It was a concept. It was a stopping point. I didn't think that we'd end up with a farm in the mountains. But
okay, so tell me about Los Angeles. When your parents moved over there, were you born at that point, or were you born in Southern California?
Yeah, I was born in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. So grew up around the ocean. My father had spent time. A lot of time sailing and scuba diving and yeah.
So every guest we speak to, there's always a clear story in terms of their parental support and the importance of their guidance. Could you reflect on that and talk about who was more influential in your upbringing? Or if they were both influential, what roles did they play?
Yeah, I think it would sort of be hard to rank one over the other.
Certainly if they hear it. They go, oh,
yeah. I think just learn different styles and different things from different sides. Most definitely from my father's side, the value of hard work was, and the actual doing was something that was instilled in me through sports, particularly through baseball.
So your father, in relation to sports, instilled in you a work ethic through the baseball?
Yeah, I would say a lot of lessons through sports when I look back now on growing up, particularly work ethic. sort of leadership skills. Something that I now think back on that's interesting is this kind of a concept of being in the zone, mm-hmm. which I sort of have a different eye on now as I've gotten a little bit older and started to kind of be able to listen to insights that happen in that state. I think both with the two of them grew up in very different. So my mother in a Jewish household and my father in a Catholic household, one of Irish Catholic, one of 10, they had different experiences. And so I got a diverse range of viewpoints to base sort of my understanding of the world.
Your worldview. Yeah, definitely. What about siblings?
I'm an only child. So I had a lot of, I think in that way, it allowed for an adoption of siblings, mm-hmm. A lot of family members, cousins, and friends that basically played the similar role to older brother, younger sister.
Even out in LA?
Yeah, most definitely. When I look back through my years, there's always somebody who was part of a larger extended family that... Mm-hmm. So I grew up also sort of as the youngest son in a Cuban family who lived a few blocks from us. It was always part of my identity growing up because it's had a nursery. My parents divorced when I was young and my mom was a young doctor. My father was working and so they needed a place for me to go. And there was a nursery ad just a few blocks away from where I was raised in Los Angeles. And it turned out that they
embraced you.
Yeah.
Must have been quite an interesting sort of fusion of cultures coming from a sort of a Irish Catholic Jewish background and then mixed in with a bit of Cuban.
Cuban and Mexican as well.
Yeah. So did you learn to speak Spanish at an early age?
So when I was young, Spanish was a second language for me, but I was quite obstinate in that I would only speak in English, but I could understand and it was something I regretted when I look back on it as I started to need to be able to speak Spanish more. But it was always part of my identity growing up. And when I look back, people ask about this sort of progression to being a farmer growing up in Los Angeles. A lot of the people that raised me and were part of that experience made agricultural lessons part of the dynamic in which I grew up. My Cuban grandfather, he sold birds in the back of the house and had pineapple plants and mangoes. And when I think back in it, actually the first apple I ever picked off of a tree that I have memory of was in that backyard. It was a Granny Smith apple.
So at that age, these subliminal cues were being embedded or seeds were being embedded.
Seeds were being planted.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
That's really interesting. What about the role of play in your life and your freedom to explore? I mean, I know big cities can vary, particularly cities like Los Angeles. Did you ever have a sense that the world was yours to explore, or were you protected and cosseted?
No, I think particularly growing up in a large city, parents have to embrace some semblance of autonomousness and mm-hmm. independence. Their children growing up as an only child and sort of one with an independent mindset, there was definitely a part of me that had to be embraced. I think growing up in Los Angeles as well, there was a lot of natural experiences that were around us. Mm-hmm. I experienced through the ocean quite a lot, but then also again through sports, and I think play was always something encouraged, but within part of a larger context and scope of mm-hmm. varying experiences.
That experience of being near the ocean, and it sounds like the fusion of being in nature yet being in a city infused with the rigor and the hard work ethic of being involved with baseball set you on a certain path. What about the influence of friends and other buddies or even mentors in your life at that stage?
Most definitely. I mean, I think when I look back on particularly my high school years, there's a couple of mentors and teachers in particular that highlighted for me the importance of knowledge and particularly history. And I was always politically driven as a teenager.
Where did that come from?
I think it came from a sense of sensitivity to suffering of people around me. When I was young, my father had cancer. that sort of colored my whole childhood, my whole adolescence, growing up. I think that sort of put me in tune with a certain level of empathy. I think also other instances as well. I mean, growing up in Jewish traditional, like going, we weren't really religious. I grew up more with sort of meditation and incense than I did with Jewish symbolism or Christian symbolism.
Who's responsible for that? Your father or mother?
My mother. Definitely my mother. My father was Catholic. And I think they shared some sort of New Age sentimentalities, which I think where they met was at a seminar, a sort of New Age, one of those 1970s New Age seminars. They had very differing perspectives on what spirituality and religion were. Much more rigid and dogmatic on my father's side, I would say.
So who were these mentors or these people that influenced you when you were at that?
So I spent a lot of my teenage years not really interested in school because I was not good at it. It wasn't my...
Was it just lack of interest?
I think so, because as I got older, it changed and evolved. Uh-huh. And once I found my way, then, and those were two people that I in particular helped kind of feel that I found my way. One was my history teacher as a junior and senior year in high school. And that, I was interested in social justice, and we started nonprofits and did concerts and kind of raised a stink whenever we could about something we felt was important. But this teacher, Carol Winter, in junior year of high school, she showed me the historical context of a lot of the things that I was looking at and the power that was in... I was reading Zinn and People's History, and an alternative side of a knowledge system that was not being widely expressed. Mm-hmm. And that was a powerful connection. I think because school felt so rigid and it was a box that I didn't fit into, or at least not everything. But then I sort of found my way through that lens to be able to understand kind of the power that was in that. And then also at the same time, I had a librarian and mentor on the sort of social justice side who fostered our ability and our independence to like do an all day fundraising concert at the Whiskey A Go-Go at 14 for ratification on the UN Rights of the Child. There was an interesting influence that sort of shaped the perspective of the world. I think it unlocked a powerful door.
So that's interesting that these two parallel directions of social justice, but also an interest in history, and particularly in terms of the historical context of that point in time, could have taken down two different routes. You could have gone down the nonprofit route. You could have gone down the historical educational option and path as well. But you didn't. You went down the route. We're going to start jumping ahead slightly, but you followed a sort of political science pathway.
Yeah, I mean, I think I did a little bit of both. Because of that love of social justice, nonprofit work was kind of just part of the thing. So whether it was doing stuff with the ocean or with other sort of causes in that way. And then I also, I think where I really started to find myself, my father passed away when I was 19. So up until that point, school sort of seemed secondary in importance. And when I look back at graduating from high school, I applied for one college and didn't write an essay. So I actively knew that I needed to sort of delay where I was. And when I was in community college after he passed away, I finally was able to kind of make it all congeal. And I'd started working at KCRW, it's an NPR station in Southern California. And that was where I saw community, I think, for the first time growing up in such a big city. I mean, I think I knew community in my baseball field and I knew it in various different places. But there was a true sense of a larger connection to a social good as well. And that was a framework for me graduating from I ended up transferring to UCLA and then finally and did a double track major with history and political science because then it all sort of
came together.
It all came together.
Perfect fusion.
So I think from there, my first job, I in college, I had worked for Arianna Huffington and was kind of had heard, was just sort of like exposed to an interesting political mindset at the time and graduated from college. I've been fortunate that I was told by a diverse clan of folks around me, not to go straight to into like to graduate and go straight into career. So I spent a little bit of time traveling, but I did end up kind of on that 9-to-5
treadmill.
Got a good dose of it.
Is there anything in your memory or any defining moment or memory from your childhood that was pivotal in the direction that you've taken?
I mean, I think it would be finding out that my father had cancer and the moment when I left the hospital when he passed away. I think those were kind of, those were profound moments for me. And when I was 14, being taken on a trip to Indonesia, that was an experience of connection to a wider world for the first time, seeing certain forms of poverty and giving an understanding and appreciation of how fortunate.
The privilege of being that 1%.
Absolutely.
Smaller than 1%.
Just being able to have clean air, fresh water, not be concerned about your safety, be healthy and happy. And I think those are things that people strive for universally.
So with those defining moments in your life, actually, I'm going to just ask one other question about you, your youth. Were you ambitious?
Yeah, I would say so. Maybe when I think back to it, I think back to sports and wanting to be a leader and wanting to be captain of the team and but not out of a sense of like position or rank. It was wanting to be effective and wanting to feel that I had given my all. I think now, especially the older I get, the more in touch with a sense of like change that I would like to see, the more the drive and motivation to try and figure those things out. It doesn't get easier, but at least in terms of like the motivation to want to
create impact.
Mm-hmm. I think was finding this sort of sustainable fire that builds itself, that continuously a cup that refills itself.
Right. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot now and say, that sounds great. And I could see you going from there and finding yourself running community farms and having your own farm in the Catskills. But you ended up doing law. Where did it all go wrong?
Yeah. Well, I think I followed a track. I mean, I also felt that I had made a determination. Fortunately, I had spent a number of years traveling and had gotten time and space. And I thought that given the circumstances, I didn't know what to do. It was sort of a default option. And I felt that it would be effective in its ability to bring about change through a legal standpoint. I mean, there's certainly a great deal of power to having a law degree.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
or not necessarily a great deal of power, but it is an informative basis of knowledge to be able to operate.
No, one of our earliest guests, Natalie Bridgman Fields, studied law, and she witnessed injustice when she was a traveling student in Chile, seeing communities being broken up by the police and tear gassed and being challenged by the locals in Chile to say, Natalie, this is your country doing this, you have to help us. And she then had a mission to go back and use her law to litigate for change, but realized that litigation takes time. So she set up her own NGO called Accountability Council, and now works independently to drive and accelerate change for underprivileged and underserved communities. But her law, as she said herself, her law served her well. It set her on that right track. So,
and I think
I can see your point of view on
that. That to me speaks strongly about the potential impact of law. Mm-hmm. And I think was a correlation to the reason, the impact, the reason that I saw that it could promote change and have an impact.
I think also when we come and talk about the work you've been doing with the community farm, particularly in Williamsburg with North Brooklyn Farm, I suspect it gives you an immense sense of confidence knowing where you stand legally. And when someone threatens you with legal action, you know exactly where the power lies. So I think that must be a valuable asset.
Yeah, I think just in general, for people to be protective of themselves, it's a good thing. A good thing to know. I think I was fortunate in that, because it was right about the financial recession when I had been studying for about a year and a half, been living in New York.
So you finished, so just to, from timeline standpoint, you finished at UCLA doing your political science degree and then moved to New York.
So no, actually, there was a gap in between there. So I graduated, and that summer I got a job. I traveled in throughout South America. And then I ended up working at getting a job at UCLA, which I was very fortunate to have, and working in the administration, and it was as an assistant to the chair and vice chair and past chair and chief administrative officer of the Academic Senate, the body that represents the faculty in the university. And it was sort of a legal track work to that. But ultimately, I just was not happy in an office, in a cubicle, behind a computer, even no matter what the kind of effect of change was. It just, the workload became, the 9-to-5 lifestyle did not feel resonant with what a human being should be doing. And ultimately, what really happened was Barack Obama got elected. I had kind of volunteered in Nevada and tried to be part of the campaign and felt compelled by what he was doing and his message. And I was going to go to the inauguration. It was a moment in history and I wasn't going to miss it. And I didn't have vacation time. And I told my boss, like, look, I have to go to this. And he said, you can't, you don't have vacation time. So I said, thank you for helping push me in the right, I'm going. Actually, there was, in a serendipitous way, there was, I had gone over to my mother's house. I was trying to figure out what to do. I wanted to just stay on at my job, but I also felt something else beckoning, and was debating at the end of January going to DC and then traveling in South America. And I was at dinner at my mom's house and her cousin was there, and she said, oh, like, you want to go? You're going to go to Rio. My aunt lives in Rio. She has an apartment right near Copacabana Beach. Like, go stay with her. And that sort of sealed the deal. It was like, okay, that's what we're doing. So I spent a year almost traveling throughout South America. And then eventually I was teaching English in Korea. I ran out of money, and English teaching jobs were a thing. Like, the girl that I was in the relationship at the time, we got our TEFL certificates and spent a year teaching in Korea. And then I came back, we broke up, and I was trying to figure out the place to go. And New York, in also a serendipitous way, one of my sort of older sister types had reached out to me, and that kind of, it ended up pulling me in that direction. I had an offer to potential work at a job at a law firm. They were doing civil rights, sexual harassment type cases, high profile cases. And it was, okay, let's give New York a try. I'm studying for the LSAT. I'm going to go to law school. And right about that time, it was like, after about a year in New York, the financial crisis was happening. Things weren't looking good for the job market, and I recognized that I would have hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and would not be able to take the type of, social activist type of job and be able to exist in New York City or like anywhere really once you have that kind of debt, which is sort of a plague of our generation at this point, I would say.
Unless Bernie gets in and then reverses that.
We'll see. There's so many obstacles, I think. But
So you're New York. So where from so making then, this decision around the potential downsides of the debt, where did it pivot to your interest in urban and community farming?
So right before I had left for New York, I mean, as I had said, growing up, when I was a teenager, I started just growing cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers and whatever I could on our small little patio in Venice. Yeah. And that sort of evolved over time. And finally, after 2 years on a waiting list, I ended up with a community garden space. Mm. So that I found personal peace and solace in gardening. And I took that with me to New York. So when I was working at the law firm, I was fortunate enough to find a space at the automotive high school garden across from McCarran Park. Mm-hmm. That was in my neighborhood on the border of Greenpoint and Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And that place was my solid, it was the sort of light to my dark.
And it just kept you sane through those 9 to 5, the drudgery of training to be a lawyer.
Yeah. Just like spending time sitting, collating papers. And ultimately there was like the breaking point was on a July day, and it was in the like 80s. It was beautiful. The office was like near the city hall, and it was like a beautiful day. And I was inside, I'd like gone out to have lunch and sit in the park. And I come back into the office and I have a sweater on, and the amount of like waste and electricity and paper and staggering on a multiplied basis across New York City. Mm-hmm. Just like growing up as a Californian, we were kind of imbued with certain kind of environmental dogma that it was kind of staggering. Like this is very different even than my like California office experience. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of the day that did it. But I think the thing that really did it was like I saw my bosses and they weren't happy. They didn't seem happy with their lives. Like they were successful. They should, if that was what they wanted to be
doing. In terms of
doing,
career progression, of course, success, but yeah, life success.
And like, you know, externally from a family point of view, like everything, you know, you have the home, you have the family, you have the thing, the career, but like not the time or the presence to be with your children or to be able to, and granted, I see like it's probably a skewed segment of that, but that was enough for me to like, okay, maybe there's something different I should be doing. And there was a book called The $100 Startup, Chris Gillibo, and that, and my girlfriend at the time, it was like this concept of how do you do what you love and make money out of it? And so what I thought, what do I love doing? And it was like, I love growing vegetables because it makes me happy. Yeah. And I think on my dad's side of the family, everybody had a trade, a skill. My dad could like take an engine apart and put it back together. My uncle was a pilot. The other one was a fisherman and all hands on deck, whatever he could do, anything. And I never, as a like sort of intellectual political activist type, never had a chip on my shoulder. So being a farmer fit into my family dynamic quite well. And also like as I got older and found out that my grandfather had a small farm in like it would have been like 60s, 70s, just south of Massachusetts, south of Boston.
Oh, right.
And that actually was that for me as well. At that time, I had my uncle was very influential for me and gave me the first place to grow in the ground and have like, here's this space, like go do it. And he was the first to recognize, he was like, you want to be a farmer. That's what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because in terms of lessons learned and lessons I think that I take away from the whole experience of North Brooklyn Farms has been, I remember being in Massachusetts with my uncle visiting him when I was working at the law firm and being like, hey, you know, there's this crazy request for proposals that I found, and it's this empty lot, and we could turn it into this farm, and the developer's like, he was all...
You were still at the law firm at this point.
I was still at the law firm, and now I would go, I had like a field of butternut squash and Roma tomatoes growing up there in Massachusetts. The town is Scituate, where my family grew up. And my uncle was a caretaker of this property, and I had the community garden, and then I had this other, I'd take the mega bus back with like a box full of tomatoes. Sort of silly, but he recognized that that's more so than I did, that that was what I wanted to do. And he encouraged me to just, we used to just bounce crazy ideas off each other all the time. He was a very influential voice in my head at the
because what was this 2012 2013
yeah it was 2012 because 2013 in the winter
at that time
it would have been summer 2012.
I'm trying to think who the mayor was at the time. Was it still Bloomberg?
I think it was still Bloomberg.
It was before de Blasio.
Yeah,
it wasn't exactly a city that you would look to having a thriving community farm.
It was a thing at the time. It was with Brooklyn Grange starting. I mean, it's New York City has such a thriving community garden culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of this self-sufficient, self-sustainable, but also just like tough, like I'm going to kind of do this on my own. And also the history of vacant lots. Mm-hmm. And that's a really powerful sort of transition point.
What's the history of vacant lots?
Well, so I mean, sort of you think about New York City before its current iteration, like sort of
before
like 70s, 80s.
Gentrification.
Yeah. I mean, it was gnarly. I mean, it was growing up as a kid in the 90s, my conceptualization of New York City was like it was a scary place, and like getting mugged was a regular occurrence. And so in the economic crisis of New York City with burned down lots, and you would have once in a city, if there is, I think for long enough, you have a piece of land that sits vacant, it ends up attracting something that you don't necessarily want it to be part of your community and part of your neighborhood, and part of taking back control was this process of communities reclaiming empty lots. That for me is super powerful and was a precedent we looked at. I mean, that was when I quit my job at the law firm. I started getting involved more. One thing that was really fortunate is that I had asked my boss, the law firm, about getting involved in community politics in New York, or like about getting involved with my neighborhood. Because someone said something to me that was impactful in thinking about gentrification, and being a white male in my 30s, it was important to me to think about my place and my role in the city, and to be a sole impact on what that is. And someone had said to me, or read somewhere, if you're going to be part of gentrifying a neighborhood, which had some semblance of inevitability, just based upon the place where we were at, do something to make it better. And so I wanted to try and at Greenpoint also has a history of like activism and social community driven, like very, very vocal residents. Mm-hmm. And I ended up working for a local nonprofit, the Greenpoint GWAP, the Greenpoint Waterfront Association for Parks and Planning, it was initially Greenpoint Williamsburg against the power plant. They had stopped Con Edison from building a power plant in the neighborhood
because there had been pollution and oil spills in the way back in Greenpoint.
Yeah, Greenpoint is the ground zero of like industrial revolution pollution for going back back to the 1800s, and as the industrialization of New York happened, the Newtown Creek is sort of like,
there's people who don't know Greenpoint that might have been to New York. It sits across the East River just to the north of Williamsburg, which is the known to many people as a sort of hipster, at one point the hipster area of New York, now gentrified. And Greenpoint is buffers Williamsburg and then crossing on to Long Island City.
Yeah, exactly. So Greenpoint would be is the most northern neighborhood of Brooklyn that separates Queens from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And that proximity, and then it's also directly close to Manhattan. So that proximity to both to three boroughs and also the history of industry along the Newtown Creek and waterways as transportation of the time served as a kind of concentration of industrialization. Mm-hmm. And then particularly there's an oil processing facility that had what's behind Exxon Valdez is the longest oil spill on record. It was 20, 30 years, something like
that. Incredible.
Yeah, and can sort of add to that the other sort of environmental things that have happened there, and the fact that like most trash gets transported through Greenpoint, and there's so the, it'll create which a citizenry leads, that's yeah, kind yeah. of like a little bit outraged.
Yeah, quite right.
And I think also because this results in higher like incidence of cancer and other profound health impacts that are disproportionately kind of set upon a particular neighborhood based on historical kind of preference.
Yes. So you got involved in that action group, and then what led? So at this point, you were doing this with permission of your law firm.
Yeah, this was sort of like a side. This was like my this was sort of just like a side project.
Okay. Right.
That I was just doing in my neighborhood. My girlfriend and I at the time ran the website, and they had gotten a grant to do a community blog. And so we were running the website and kind of running social media for them and sort of like the young side of the community activists. Yeah. So
how did that evolve from there to finding out about the RFP for this community farm? Was it a community? It was an RFP for what? There was a vacant space.
So what happened was it was about September. I quit my job, September 2012. And I decided that I was going to go into urban farming and made the phone call to my mom.
So you made the decision. This is the $100 startup.
This was exactly.
It was start a farm on $100.
It was like, I called my mom and was like, I'm not going to law school. I'm not going to take the LSAT. Mm-hmm. I'm quitting my job and I'm going to like go into urban farming. I think it's the right thing to do. And
she must have had a fairly colorful reaction to that.
Yeah, it was... hesitation and doubt. I was sort of I was like, I'll be okay, like I'm not gonna end up homeless. And she like, okay, no, like I'm doing this for a reason. And
was she still in LA?
Yeah, she's still in LA. But she comes out here every once in a while. So we sort of like I from that at that point I started working at the Battery Urban Farm, and I was education apprentice there, so working with the school visits. And then I had gotten accepted into the Brooklyn Urban Gardener program at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. That was a extremely formative experience for me, and very another serendipitous fortunate turn of events,
because if you hadn't done that, you wouldn't have had the skills to win the RFP.
I think it was just sort of like this collective accumulation of disparate knowledge bases that all of a sudden had meaning and singularity of purpose. Yes. Once the sort of farm concept came together.
So this request for proposal, who was it from?
So what had happened was I was working with GWAP and running the website, and the Domino project was a major, the purchase of the Domino factory. Sugar factory in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It was enormously historic piece of property that was served as the number one producer of like the majority of sugar through the continental United States. And the historic importance of sugar in the United States, our economy and the social implications that go along with it are vast and diverse. So it was like an important, it employed the neighborhood. I mean, it was a huge fixture, and it was the largest building sort of back in the day on the waterfront. It was an imposing structure of industry.
Structure, yeah.
It's a beautiful, beautiful building. And so the purchase of it and the development of that space was of high importance to the community. Mm-hmm. People were interested and engaged with what was going to happen. And initially, there was a movement to try and stop the Save Domino and, mm-hmm. and to turn it into someone to buy it as like an art complex. This was already sort of after the point it had already been purchased. Mm-hmm. And because of that sort of like community focus, I found the request for proposals had gone out from Two Trees, the developer who had purchased the property. And it was a 50,000 square foot lot that had sat vacant for a decade. It was the former parking lot of the factory, and it was in Williamsburg next to the bridge, right close to the waterfront. And it had a lot of potential. It was a beautiful, beautiful big open lot. And that was a pastime of both mine and Henry's, like to sort of walk around.
Who's Henry?
Henry is my partner at North Brooklyn Farms, who I had met at the Battery Urban Farm. He was the farm manager there at the time. And we both had this idea of what a farm in the city could be that was different than anything that we had seen previously. Most of the farms were either like agricultural focused or education focused, and they weren't really about community. And not to say that there wasn't a community there. All of those farms have very strong community cultures, but it wasn't about open public embracing of people and of the farm as a fixture, as part of the social fabric of a community.
Destination.
A destination in and of itself, and also of a respite, of a natural oasis in a crazy chaotic city.
Yeah, indeed. understatement.
Yeah.
So that encounter with meeting Henry must have been also another serendipitous step on the direction to actually submitting that RFP. What happened when you submitted the RFP? Well, there must have been other Williamsburg hipster entrepreneurs with grand ideas wanting to do something 50,000 square feet other than a community farm.
So that absolutely, there was a lot of people that put proposals in, and that we sort of found out more and more after as the process unfolded. Actually, originally we weren't even selected. We were, so as part of this sort of serendipitous turn of events, Henry and I, when we kind of went together to put together a proposal, it was just the two of us. We didn't have an organization. We didn't have a business. We didn't have like liability insurance or any of the sort of things that we just had, like this idea and a determination to try and bring it about. And through like serendipitous circumstances, somebody, through a friend of a friend, was at a birthday party. And this guy was also putting in a proposal for the same lot to build something sort of like more of a party venue. Mm-hmm. And they had had a church in Bushwick where they had held events and things like that. And we ended up submitting our proposal as like a sub licensee of Bobby Red, the organization that submitted the primary proposal. We were sort of the agricultural component. And so we rode in on the coattails, essentially, was how we ended up getting in on the request for proposal. And then there was also, there were three projects that were chosen. That was Bobby Red and then North Brooklyn Farms as part of the agricultural, and then the Brooklyn Bike Park, which we became neighbors, all sharing the same space and figure. We didn't, no one knew what they were doing. No, this was all new. There was no paradigm for us to follow. It was a public park space, event space in a community, but like privately owned and privately run by three separate different groups and like doing different things and with no funding. So there was that. We were young.
You were thrown in the deep end and said, right, you've got 7 years.
Very much. Very much so. And we had a year to get the request for proposals was for a year.
Oh, that's all. Right.
So people thought we were crazy. They were like, what are you building a farm for a year? Like, that doesn't make any sense. We always knew it was sort of like, if this works, it works, and it's not going to be a year. If it does what we think that it should. And it took a while. It took a few years till we moved across the street. We didn't know if people understood what our intention was with the space that we were trying to create.
You had the first year, you established the space, and then two trees made you move across the road
because
to the waterfront.
Because of the sort of bureaucratic nightmare of trying to fit this like round peg into a square hole, like the Department of Buildings had no way of evaluating what we were. And for Bobby Redd and the head of that organization, he went straight into a wall of like New York City bureaucracy that just couldn't like just say, yes, this is okay. It's like an outside event space without making it overly complicated. And I think the combination of that and like construction, no funding and things that they ended up by the end of the first year, they ended up kind of falling off because it was difficult. Yeah. I mean,
the bureaucracy, it was too much effort
and just endless amounts of money that nobody had and stress and time. And it was all new. I was working I had gotten a job at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and I remember during the like interview, they're like, "What are you gonna do if you get the Domino Project?" I was like, "That's not gonna." I remember like literally in my head thinking like, "That's not gonna." It probably was part of my answer. It was like, "It's very unlikely that that's gonna happen." Like it seemed so implausible to like have a billionaire developer give you a multi-million piece of property. Like, here you go, just
start growing,
do something good with it. And that was, it was mission driven. We were compelled by doing something good for our community and for being like, we were so lucky. We got given like the chance of a lifetime that like most people never get.
Okay, that's the end of part one. Come back tomorrow for part two, when Ryan and I discuss his experience of running North Brooklyn Farms for 7 years and the impact it had on local community in Brooklyn and beyond. If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review because it helps more people find us. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, or your favourite podcast player to listen and subscribe. This show is an Impossible Network production and is produced by Bettina McKaylee and Elaine Castillo-Keller. But for now, be curious, be creative, and seek out serendipity. See you next time.